There are politicians who, after losing 5 presidential elections, would take the hint. Then there is Hakainde Hichilema, who last month got elected president of Zambia at the 6th attempt. At this early stage of his term, President Hichilema could be forgiven for wondering why he wanted the job so ardently. He has reported discovering a more or less empty state treasury and a hole in the national finances much deeper and wider than he'd anticipated. And it is not like Hichilema did not have other means of occupying his time. He is one of Zambia's richest people, with interests in property, tourism, ranching, and healthcare. But his long unrequited desire for Zambia's presidency was not a mere hobby. By his own count, he has been arrested 15 times by various powers that be, including one imprisonment of several weeks in 2017, pending charges of treason, later dropped. It is obviously far too early to declare Hichilema's election a bright new dawn for his country, never mind his continent. They gave Abiy Ahmed a Nobel Peace Prize, and look how that went. And the world at large has acquired a certain suspicion of buccaneering businessmen claiming a unique ability to solve political problems. How has Hakainde Hichilema triumphed at last? Could he be the key that unlocks Zambia's potential? And what effect might he yet have on aspiring leaders across Africa? This is the Foreign Desk.
Zambia has demonstrated that leadership can be transferred from one political party to another, from one president to another, peacefully without a lot of conflict. So Zambia is seen as a good example of how politics should be managed and performed.
The more Hakainde Hichilema was being sought by law enforcement agencies, and the more they accused him of things and failed to find evidence and convict him, the more the Zambian people became wary and wondered why exactly there are so many allegedly false claims against the gentleman and no conviction.
Since the election of a new Zambian president and the death of the country's founding father, I have asked my family, my young cousins especially, what their hopes are for the country. I find it noteworthy that almost all of them say that the election results have brought a new dawn for the country.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. Zambia became independent in 1964, though the reputation it has since established as a bastion of relative order in southern Africa is merited, the journey has not been an altogether smooth one. Well, joining me now from Lusaka is Bizek J. Piri, Professor of History at the University of Zambia. Professor, let's go back to the point at which Zambia starts to emerge from British rule and become a country in its own right. Before that, what kind of rule were the British running over what was then known as Northern Rhodesia?
When the country was known as Northern Rhodesia, as we're aware, the country was colonized about 1890. At that time, there were two Northern Rhodesians. There was Northeastern Rhodesia and Northwestern Rhodesia, which were amalgamated in 1911 as Northern Rhodesia. And then during that part of that period, it was under the British South Africa Company. Then in 1924, the British Colonial Office took over and began to manage the country as a whole as Northern Rhodesia under the Colonial Office based in London. And that went on until 1963, when there were elections. At that time, there were political parties that had been formed, among which was the African National Congress and the United National Independence Party, UNIP, and the UFP, which was a party for white people. In the election that took place in 1963, none of the three parties won election, but the African National Congress under Harimanga Nkumbula and the UNIP under Kenneth David Kaunda formed a coalition, and President Kaunda became the prime minister until when we had the next elections in 1964, when UNIP won the elections and UNIP formed the first government at independence on 24th October 1964. At the time when the African National Congress under Harimanga Nkumbula and UNIP were competing in 1964 elections, the idea was to form a government which was going to unify the 73 ethnic groups in Zambia at that time. So UNIP emerged as the winner of those elections because it had an ideology which was sold to the Zambian people at the time. So it emerged as the winner. But the African National Congress was not different either, because both political parties were fighting to emerge from the colonial government. However, there was a feeling among the nationalists that Harimwanga Nkumbura was much more sympathetic to the colonial government. So that kind of gave him less people supporting his party. UNIP emerged because UNIP was considered as more on a party that he was most charged to fight for independence. So because of that, that's what differentiated the two political parties.
It's always an interesting question at a key moment of history, how much difference one person makes. But Kenneth Kaunda, who of course only died quite recently, does emerge as the absolutely crucial figure of Zambia's post-independence history. He stays president for 27 years. How different does this timeline potentially look if he's not there? Is the country built entirely in his image?
Well, first and foremost, as you have rightly pointed out, President Kaunda ruled Zambia for 27 years. But in those 27 years, there were two political systems under which he ruled. He ruled in what was referred to as the First Republic, which was 1964 to 1973, which was a multi-party democracy, where the African National Congress Party was the opposition party. But 1973, the country moved from a multi-party democracy to what was referred to as the one-party participatory democracy. The idea of the one-party participatory democracy was to try and unite people, because the multi-party democracy of the First Republic, there used to be a lot of conflict between the different supporters of UNIP and the African National Congress. So as a way of lessening conflict during elections, that's how the one-party participatory democracy was born, among other reasons that were given.
During that period when Zambia was a one-party state, with Kenneth Kaunda as its absolutely unchallengeable supreme authority, was there much resistance to him or any worry that he'd turned into a bit of an autocrat?
At some point, there was a feeling among the Zambians that he had become, or he was moving towards autocracy, and he was not allowing others to come in. And therefore, because of that, other political parties began to emerge to form political parties, which were formed. Now, before the formation of the political parties, there was some kind of resistance on the part of UNIP to allow other political parties. But when the pressure grew, President Kaunda decided to amend the constitution to allow other political parties to be formed.
How is Kenneth Kaunda thought of now by Zambians? Is he generally seen as this heroic figure who subsequent presidents have struggled to create an identity in the shadow of, or is he very much thought of as yesterday's man?
When the one-party state came, there was a lot of feeling that he was a dictator. So when the movement came to won elections, he was kind of seen as a person that had not done what the Zambians wanted. However, with time, Michael Sata came, there was a kind of rebuilding. People began to look at Kaunda as a person who had built a strong foundation for uniting Zambia. Now we see that through that process, including up to the time when we're having the elections in August this year, there was that very strong feeling talking about going back to uniting Zambia and quoting and citing what Kaunda stood for to unite the 73 ethnic groups. So now, especially after Kaunda's death, there's this strong belief and feeling that he's one person among the politicians, the presidents in this country, who actually united this country. When you listen to people talk, they are looking at Kaunda, looking at Kaunda's era as a period that built the foundation for building a strong Zambia.
How does it strike you that Zambia's trajectory since independence has been different from, say, Zimbabwe or Mozambique or Malawi or Tanzania? And how would you account for those differences?
During the era of Kaunda, from the time that the country became independent in 1964, Kaunda was among the leaders who said they needed to support the independence of the other countries that were still under colonial rule. Therefore, Zambia became a hub and is a country where most refugees were fighting for independence in Angola, Southwest Africa, Namibia today, Mozambique, were all hosted in Zambia. Now, the Zambians also were encouraged to support others that were fighting. Now, that also had a telling effect on the Zambian economy because of that support. But it could be explained. People understood why the situation was going that way. So because of that, Zambia, therefore, because it supported the other countries, despite being a landlocked country, it became to be seen as a symbol of uniting not just the Zambians, but uniting the people in the region. It's because of that that Zambia became the founding nation of what was known as the frontline states, fighting and supporting the freedom of other countries. And it was from the frontline states that we begin to see the development and the growth of the Southern African Development Community today. And because of that, other nations surrounding Zambia have always looked at Zambia as one of the leading nations in uniting not just the Zambians, but the people in the region as a whole.
Do you think that Zambia still fills that role or could fill that role again? There's certainly been a lot of commentary by opposition leaders in some of those neighbouring countries, notably Tanzania and Zimbabwe, that they do see President Hakainde Hichilema as something of an inspiration and something of a potential role model.
When the inauguration of the current president was taking place, there was a lot of support from dignitaries, heads of state coming from the neighboring countries to come and be part of the day when Hakainde Hichilema was being inaugurated as the seventh president of Zambia. That itself seems to have inspired a lot of neighbors looking at Zambia as a country where transition from one leader, one political party to another was taking place peacefully, because that it has not been easy in other countries. When one political party loses elections, there's all been conflict. But Zambia has demonstrated that peace can be transferred, leadership can be transferred from one political party to another, from one president to another, peacefully without a lot of conflict. So Zambia is seen as a good example of how politics should be managed and performed.
Bizek Perry, thank you very much for joining us. That was Professor Bizek J. Perry from the University of Zambia. You're listening to The Foreign Desk on Monocle 24. Joining me now from Kitwe is Michael Kaluba, a news reporter at Phoenix FM Zambia. Michael, let's begin with the reason we're doing this program, which is Zambia's new president and what he hopes to accomplish. If you were to introduce our listeners to President Hakainde Hichilema, how would you describe him?
I would describe Hakainde Hichilema as, to steal his own words, a Kato boy that grew up in the rural parts of Zambia, went through the system, a bursary from government to earn himself his education qualifications, a businessman, he's a politician and a family man, and finally, the president of the Republic of Zambia.
It's not his first go round at this. If I've counted right, this is the sixth time he's run for president after failing to make it five times. What's your sense of why Zambians voted for him this time when they didn't all the other times?
This one, if you conduct an assessment on the ground, is pretty much the Zambian people voting the previous regime out, less than it is about them voting for President Hakainde Hichilema into office. The past five or six times, there hasn't been really much that has changed from his campaign strategies, except maybe for one or two aspects that could have played a bigger role, which include his presence on social media and his ability now to connect to the Zambian people better than he has done in the past five campaigns.
Is it clear which parts of the Zambian people he was connecting with? Was he especially popular with any particular age demographics or any particular regions? Who are his people?
Initially, President Hichilema had a restriction. I think it was one of the things that worked against him. He had so much popularity in southern province, as well as western and northwestern provinces, where his people are, his tribesmen. But I think over the past 5 years, he rebranded himself and started connecting more to people from other parts of the country. And also, the biggest score that the president had prior to the election was his connection with the youths. If you look at the population of Zambia, the youths constitute over 70% of the population. And so it gave him an edge the moment he had that connection with the youths.
You mentioned earlier his use of social media, which obviously has become a bigger part of electoral processes all over the world. Was that an important part of that connection with youth in particular? And if so, how did he do it? What was his social media strategy?
Firstly, going through the past 7 years, Hagai Ndehichilema has faced all manner of intimidation from the state. He's been thrown into jail. Even within the official 90 days campaign period, he wasn't allowed to campaign freely. And so what he did was he initiated a series of social media campaigns. And so I would say, off the top of my head, maybe about 60, 70% of his campaigns were done on social media. He's usually called HH. That's what he's always been called. But going into this election, he was referred to as Bali. And that is a name that was given to him by one of the youths on Twitter. And he had this new figure about him that just appealed to the youth. He would make jokes using, you know, street language that the youths can relate to. He would explain his economic policies tailored for youths to understand. He's not talking micro and macroeconomics, but he's talking about our day-to-day lives, except he's mixing it with how he's going to achieve that for the youths. He spoke about how he would create jobs, how free education would be gained in the country, and also looking at how he wants the youths to emulate him. He started his business when he was very young. He became an entrepreneur in his early 20s. And so he appealed to the youths because he was giving them hope to say, you don't need to be thrown in the corner. You have to think outside the box. Once you vote me in, all these things are available for you.
You mentioned there his brushes with the law. I mean, probably the most important one of which was when he was arrested and charged with treason under the previous presidency of Edgar Lungu in 2017. Is it possible that that ended up being an advantage for him, that he was able to sell that as part of his anti-establishment credentials?
The man found a way to communicate that without actually using those words. I think one of the things that he did first when he was sworn in was to change the service chiefs. He was very passionate about upholding human rights, guaranteeing people the freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of movement, freedom of association. These are some of the things that his party and his members had to suffer for. They would be thrown into jail for having a small meeting of 5 or 6 people. So in a nutshell, the more Hagai Ndehichilema was being sought by law enforcement agencies, and the more they accused him of things and failed to find evidence and convict him, the more the Zambian people became wary and wondered why exactly there are so many allegedly false claims against the gentleman and no conviction at all. So treason was part of this whole scenario that reminded people to say, this is Zambia. The rule of law is more important than supporting a political stance.
That sacking of the chiefs of the Zambian military and police, which is an extraordinarily bold and decisive maneuver, is he running a big risk there? Is he making the kind of enemies that might come back after him in the future?
Whether or not he's taking a risk, I may not explicitly state. But what I can point you to is that Zambia almost always has changed the entire leadership of the service chiefs, the Zambia National Service, the Zambia Army, the Zambia Air Force, the Zambia Police, the Zambia Correctional Services, when we change government. Going down in history, you go to 1991, moving from the UNIP government into the MMD government, the same happened. In 2011, moving from the MMD government into the Patriotic Front government, the same happened. But one of the things that the president spoke of when he made this decision was the fact that the past 7 years have been some of the most difficult for Zambia to uphold human rights. And so what he wants to achieve is to ensure that, for example, the Zambia police, he wants service to become more professional, to guarantee the safety of people, their human rights. He made a very interesting remark when he was swearing in the new Inspector General of Police. He told them, do not arrest anyone before conducting investigations. Do not detain anyone beyond the stipulated 48 hours all in the name of fixing them because they are a political opponent of somebody. And those are the things that he wants to achieve. So the hope of many Zambians is that this decision does not backfire.
Let's have a think about how he intends to govern and I guess what the early months and years of his term could look like. We know a bit about his past, that he is this serial presidential contender and also this extremely wealthy self-made businessman. But as a politician, does it strike you that there are any parallels? Does he have any inspirations, any idols, any other leaders anywhere else in the world that he wants to be a bit like?
Looking at the 15 years that he has spent in the opposition and the kind of things that were said about him, claims about him being the one that sold off the Zambian assets during the privatization era in the early to the late 90s, they speak of him being somebody that would want to sell the country to the highest bidder. Really, there hasn't been much narrative about the man as he is, other than all those scenarios that have been thrown around. But looking at the past 2 to 3 years, when he did finally get to connect with people, he became much more clearer about what he wants to do. And that is making Zambia a production house, to make sure Zambia becomes an exporter more than an importer, to grow the production of copra, which is basically our backbone of the economy, to grow the production like the new finance minister stated, from the current around 800,000 to 900,000 metric tons to about 3 million metric tons per annum, and also grow income in terms of revenue collection so that free education is available, so that more nurses are employed, more teachers are employed, more jobs are available.
You said earlier that this time people were not so much voting for him as against his predecessor. That being the case, how patient do you think Zambians will be with him, especially those younger Zambians who have been such a big part of his constituency?
If history is anything to go by, I would say Zambians have become less and less patient. The Kaunda presidency ruled the country for 27 years. The Movement for Multi-Party Democracy, the MMD, with I think three presidents, ruled the country for 20 years. The Patriotic Front government, with two presidents, ruled the country for only 10. And here we are with the United Party for National Development, who, by the way, have promised a lot of what Zambians are really expecting would better their lives. And so if the president and his team fail to deliver, the chances of the Zambians speaking again like they spoke this year are very high.
Michael, thank you for joining us. That was the journalist Michael Kaluba of Phoenix FM Zambia. Finally, on today's show, a personal reflection on Zambia by a member of Monocle 24's staff who knows it well, Monocle producer and editor Steph Chungu.
Stepping off the plane, I feel heat seeping into my clothes all over. Already, it's a stark difference arriving in Zambia compared to chilly England. Usually, I'm used to heavy rain and cloudy skies in July, so arriving in a country where one can immediately see and feel the sun's 25 plus degree heat, it doesn't take me long to acclimatise. Evenings in Zambia also can't compare to British nights, not one bit. Dropping to low tens, it's not unusual to see people out and about wearing thick sweaters and trousers, rushing to get home in order to escape the cold. My family are all spread across the country, so when I visit, I like to split my time between the two families before returning to the capital city of Lusaka. First, I travel to see my dad's side of the family in Kabwe. It's a small town where everyone knows everyone. I can remember its market stalls overflowing with eager shoppers who are there every day to shop, chat, haggle and bargain. My mother's side of the family mostly reside in Kitwe, a town well known for housing a disproportionately large number of young people studying to become midwives at the University of Zambia. One of the university's main campus is located in the town centre. While in Kitwe, my cousins will make the effort to introduce me to some of their friends, many of whom are connected to influential members of Zambian society, working hard to change the country for the better. A large number of family gatherings and festivities are held whenever I visit. Friends from across the country would make the long trip to the capital to see us, greet us, and they're never empty-handed. They bring food my parents aren't able to enjoy in England, like impwa, chibwabwa, chikanda. It'll all be laid out with the meat, potatoes, and nshima, like some kind of Zambian banquet. It's usually at these parties that my uncles, aunts, and the rest of the family would update us about the developments, or undevelopments, on the part of the government. They would complain about the previous administration's poor leadership for running the country into the ground. Zambia became Africa's first country to default on foreign debt during the coronavirus pandemic. The government's attempt to tackle the spread of the virus have been lackluster at best, but cases are now dropping and the first UK donated vaccines are now arriving. Since the election of a new Zambian president and the death of the country's founding father, I have asked my family, my young cousins especially, what their hopes are for the country. I find it noteworthy that almost all of them say that the election results have brought a new dawn for the country, especially in an economic sense, given that unemployment is now the worst it has been in several decades. My family are hopeful that the new president will bring about opportunities and lower taxes, and considering that Zambia has voted for a businessman to take the helm of the country, I hope for the same. While I haven't been to Zambia since 2014, I can remember the beautiful views, particularly that of the southern city of Livingstone, after which we would drive to my all-time favourite spot, Victoria Falls. Straddling the borders of Zambia and Zimbabwe, it's one of the largest waterfalls in the world, and it's nothing short of spectacular. As a British Zambian expat, I had hoped to return to Zambia last year, but the pandemic has made it harder to do so, as it has for lots of people trying to return home. Zambia is still on the UK's red list, and it is unlikely to be added to the less stringent amber list anytime soon. While I am grateful to be able to connect with my family virtually over the phone, it's not the same. I can't wait for the day I get to see them again at yet another gathering in Lusaka, surrounded by tables of food, laughter, and dance. That's what I miss most about my country. Home.
That was Monocle's Steph Chungu. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer, and many thanks also to Monocle's Steph Chungu. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.